there's this glorification with getting 8 hours of sleep. And the reality is that not everyone needs 8 hours of sleep. What we're really finding that is more important than the amount of hours is the consistency. This research hasn't really been fully disseminated to the public yet. They actually looked at over 60,000 adults and found that the people who had the most regular sleep schedules had 20 to 48% lower risk of death.
What?
Yeah, it's wild.
Do you believe that sleep is just as important as nutrition and exercise?
I'm going to argue that sleep is the foundation upon which those other pillars stand. People ask me this a lot. What's more important, a consistent bedtime or a consistent wake time? It's always the...
Hello, friends. Welcome back to Cancer Proof Living. I'm so glad you're here. I'm Michelle, a 9-year non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer survivor, a mom, and a certified integrative nutrition health coach. And after cancer, I wanted more than just survival. So I built the healing roadmap that I couldn't find. Now I guide survivors and cancer-conscious humans to detox, rebuild, and thrive. In this episode, I sat down with Morgan Adams. She's a transformative holistic sleep coach for women who struggle with getting a good night's sleep consistently. Her sleep toolkit helps women improve their sleep quality and their relationship with sleep so they can live stressful days. Morgan understands firsthand how insomnia can impact quality of life and spent almost a decade dependent on prescription sleeping pills. She's also a 2-time breast cancer survivor who advocates for a lifestyle of disease prevention. You guys, this episode is one of the most important ones. We talk about sleep and what to do if you're not getting sleep and how to better structure your days for sleep. Morgan shares so many tips on how she personally repaired her relationship with sleep and what to do if you're getting up chronically at 3 a.m. and why the number of hours of sleep isn't the most important thing when it comes to getting good sleep. This episode is so informative, it will change the way you think about your morning routine and sleep overall. So grab a pen and paper because you will definitely need it. Let's get it started. Well, you guys know that I am such a huge fan of sleep, and we know how important it is, and it's something that I talk about, oh my gosh, all the time, not only on my page, but with my clients and all of my programs. Sleep is a non-negotiable. So imagine my excitement for our guest today, because that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a huge deep dive into sleep and why it's so crucial and critical for health, for cancer prevention, recovery, all of the things, right? Because we know it affects everything. So thank you, Morgan. It's so great for you to be here. And I would love to hear a little bit about your story. You know, we were talking offline and I didn't realize that you yourself are a cancer survivor too.
Yes, I am. I've had breast cancer twice. Yeah, 2018, the first diagnosis, and then 2021, the second. So I've had a very interesting, complex breast cancer experience. So lucky me, twice.
How did you find it, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, yeah, it's a really wild story, Michelle. So in 2018, my husband and I were in Jamaica on vacation, and we were actually there on the year anniversary of my mother's passing. She had passed away from breast cancer.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And my husband, this is not his profession, but he does have a gift where he can communicate with the departed. And I said to him, honey, would you see if you can communicate with mom on this day of her 1-year death anniversary and see if she has any messages for us, for me and you? And he went to his little place and he said, yeah, he delivered some messages to me. And he said, there's one more thing your mom is saying, and she wants you to get your left breast examined. And I was like, what? I know, I still get goosebumps, Michelle, telling this story. It's crazy. You can't make this stuff up.
You know what? It's not crazy. And what a blessing. And she was looking out for you.
Yeah. So that sent me on a, you know, huge, you know, chase figuring out what was going on, because I'd had a mammogram just 3 months prior to this, you know, message from mom. Well, I get home from my vacation and, you know, I kept at my doctor's, like, I really need more screening. I need, you know, an MRI. I need an ultrasound. There's something wrong. And they went through all these testings and they ultimately did find a tumor that was in my left breast. And it was a very small tumor in the early stage, stage one. We can go through the whole, like, I won't go on too long, but essentially, you know, I needed to figure out what I was going to do about it. I needed to make a decision. And based on the fact that my mom had gone through chemo and my dad actually had gone through that whole experience with colon cancer in his mid-40s, I really resisted traditional treatments. I've resisted the chemo and the radiation. And it just wasn't sitting well with me. And so I decided to pursue a more, I guess, alternative, holistic, integrative treatment. I went to a cancer center called Hope for Cancer in Mexico for like 3 weeks. And you've probably heard of it in your work with cancer. But that was a really wonderful experience as far as like understanding how to treat my body better and, you know, great practices, great habits. The tumor did not go away. Unfortunately, when I went to that center, my blood work got better, but the tumor remained. And I just monitored the tumor for about a year. So in 2019, I decided that, you know, I just didn't want to live with the tumor. So I had a lumpectomy and it was easy breezy, like no scars at all. I cleaned up my diet, seriously reduced my alcohol intake, switched over to cleaner products, you know, away from some of the toxic makeup and cleaning products, and really felt good about my life. And then in 2021, I was in the process of getting ready to do a breast explant, if you will. I was going to have my breast implants taken out. They had been in there for like 17 years. I'd gotten breast implants in my early 30s. And I just felt like, you know, these things aren't meant to last forever. they need to be taken out. I mean, they could have been replaced, but I was sort of like, okay, let me just be au naturel here. So the surgeon asked me to get a mammogram before the explant surgery. And I did it kind of begrudgingly, because the mammogram didn't catch the first cancer. But I agreed to, and they found massive DCIS, which is, you know, precancer ductal carcinoma in situ, on the opposite breast that had the lump before. And I just thought, okay, I don't want to play whack-a-mole every 3 years, you know, getting this checked out, having it always hang over my shoulder. So I went ahead and I got a double mastectomy. I've opted not to reconstruct because it seemed a little bit incongruent that I wanted these implants out of me only to have more put in. Again, they don't last forever. And at this point, I was only 51. So, you know, if I lived a fairly long lifespan, they would need to be taken out again. So that's really, you know, the story of the breast cancer situations. And I learned a lot from them, you know, but they did have their stressful moments, just like, you know, the typical breast cancer person out there, or cancer in general, stressful situation.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I know that, you know, it's deeply personal and just really vulnerable to open up about getting a diagnosis, let alone having to go through it twice. I can only imagine how scary that was when you got the implants taken out and you saw or heard that there was something else now in the right breast. Like it's just unimaginable. And it's so scary. I'm so glad that you're on the other side of it and you're better. And I'm sure you learned so much from Hope for Cancer and how to clean up the body. And I'm sure that only helped. And like, you know, God knows it could have been worse maybe if you didn't make all of those changes too. So, and like, also, just that intuition of like, I'm going to get these implants taken out, you know, just the sequence of events that happens that helps us stumble upon something that's wrong is just crazy to me. I don't believe in coincidences. So you must have had this, you know, on a deeper level, like, okay, this is the time, let's do this. And it turned out to be a blessing, because if you didn't, it would have you know, gone on for so long. So was it the MRI that found the initial left breast lump?
It was, yes. So they did an ultrasound and an MRI, and they did after just, because the mammogram didn't pick it up. Even, you know, I mean, there's mammograms are controversial, and, you know, I go back and forth on whether I like them as a screening tool. I mean, they're flawed, and we need better ones, better screening tools out there, but it did miss the lump. You know, who's to say? The lump could have aggressively spread. It could have just remained, you know, dormant, not invasive over many years. But once you know that there's something in your body, it's sort of like you can't, it's really hard to just say, well, I'm just going to see what happens. You want to take action.
It is. And it weighs on you. You want to take action. It weighs on you. And it's like, I think no matter what, when you've had cancer, and I can speak to this, right? You always worry about a reoccurrence, about it coming back. But knowing that it's still inside of you, I feel like that's a different type of worry too, where it's like, did it get bigger? Like that mental load could drive you crazy. It could drive anybody crazy. I could see how that would, and that almost in of itself is such a stressor that could help, you know, peripherally a tumor in some way too, you know?
Sure.
That is really interesting. And so your mom passed and then your dad had colon cancer. Do you guys have a genetic predisposition in the family?
I believe we do. Yeah. I was tested for the BRCA gene. I do not have that gene, but there is, maternal grandmother died of lung cancer. It's quite prevalent in my family. So there, I do believe strongly there is some genetic component, but I also am of the belief that genes don't determine your final outcome. You have control over your lifestyle choices. And that's really where I'm very, very steadfast in terms of like having made a lot of different choices for my lifestyle, because I don't want to, you know, have another cancer episode. And so, yeah, it was a wake up call for sure, because I was doing some stuff that was not, you know, beneficial to my health. And I was able to address it head on.
Yeah, the epigenetics of it all, for sure. And you're right. Like, we're all, it's so hard in this day and age in 2026 to not have some toxicity in our life and everything like that. And I think it's such a disconnect because we as individuals are not taught how to be preventative. We're not taught how to kind of go back to basics and what the foundations of health are. And once you kind of start to learn and go down that rabbit hole, you never come back out, because you realize, well, you know, you remove certain things and you start to make changes and you feel so much better. Your body reacts in such a positive way. You don't want to go back, but it's also then in the back of your mind, you're like, I know that I am influencing my cells, my genes, my everything in such a better way. You see health and a healthy lifestyle in such a broader, you know, it's like your identity. You know, you're not operating from a place of fear anymore. It's a place of empowerment. And this is how I want to live my life. This is the foundation I want to lay. It's such a different purpose when that has happened.
Agreed. And then once you make those changes, you realize how much better your body feels, because you've got a different perspective on, like, this is what feeling good really is. And once you've tasted that, you don't want to go back. You don't want to, it's giving you further reinforcement not to revert back into the bad habits that you may have had in the past. So it's kind of an ongoing, you know, let's keep moving forward and learning lessons.
Agreed. Agreed. And your mom is obviously just your angel looking out for you.
Yes, I know. And my, you know, just all the things colliding at the right time, with my husband having that gift, mom being able to relay that message to him, and me being persistent as hell and getting the, you know, testing done, because the doctors were like, we don't have anything. We haven't found anything. So, you know, you're all right. And I'm like, no, I'm not all right. We need to keep looking here.
Do you know, I actually had a really similar story. That's how I found my cancer. That's maybe why I'm not as surprised by your story as maybe an average person. But my mom passed away 1 year prior to my diagnosis from stage 4 stomach cancer. And my husband and I were her primary caregivers. And she died in our care, not in our care, but in hospice. But she was under my care. They gave her 6 weeks to live and she ended up living 6 months, but it was incredibly traumatic. And I was 30 at the time. It was just really, really horrible, really horrific. And I remember it was about a year after she passed away, I had a dream about her. And in my dream, I remember getting like out of the shower and like brushing my hair and we were like chit-chatting and all my hair started to fall out. And I was like, what's going on? And I remember my mom was like walking down a path and I was following her and I just, whatever I saw, whatever was shown to me in my dream, and I don't remember, I just resisted. And I was like, no, no, no. And I was like screaming and like resisting. And I woke up just sweating and like, almost like I, you know, when you tense up in a dream and like your hands are in a fist or whatever, it almost felt like I like jerked and like pulled a muscle in my neck. That pulled muscle in the neck led me to finding my cancer. That's what made me go to the doctor because I had zero symptoms. I was not symptomatic. And I had a stage 2 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and I had a tumor in my chest and just didn't present like normal or anything like that. So I completely think that we're always getting signs and always, you know, if we're open to it, you know, we have angels around us that can help us figure this thing called life out. And I'm so grateful because I would have not found it until it was much later down the road. And, you know, yeah, when our moms pass, they're still taking care of us.
I know. Well, it's interesting the parallel between our stories. And I do personally, curious to see what you think. I do feel like sometimes when we lose a loved one, when we're not able to properly process that grief, it can manifest in something in our body. And I feel like one of the many reasons I got my cancer is because of maybe not appropriately grieving her loss. So that's just kind of an aside. I feel like that's a pattern with a lot of people that I see.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if you've ever heard this, but they say like, oh, depending on what breast you have cancer in, like one means something. And I know one side, I think it's the left side, is for mourning and grief or is connected to like the maternal side.
Yeah.
I know. I feel like because I was a caregiver and I saw just the most traumatic things I think anybody can see when they see somebody progress through cancer and just having it be on my shoulders, I was so traumatized by it. And I kept all of my grief, and I always have like in my chest, like a lot of women manifest it in their stomach or different areas. But for me, it's always like in my chest, or I'm always like holding my breath or shallow breathing. Whenever I'm stressed out, I'm always like tight in the chest. And I had a 10 cm by 10 cm tumor in my chest. And I think numerous things contributed to my diagnosis, but I think like nail in the coffin was the stress of taking care of my mom. Like 1000%, there's no doubt in my mind because I was stuck in a state of fight or flight for a while. And it was so extreme. Yeah.
And not to mention that you were young.
Yeah. And didn't really know how to process that. Yeah.
A very young age to be dealing with a life and death scenario of a parent.
For sure. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with me. And so I'm interested, like, what have you always been into studying sleep and just interested in sleep? Or how did you kind of fall into this niche of health and wellness?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was somewhat interested in sleep, but what really kind of, there were a couple main things that kind of led me to where I am now as a sleep coach. I had chronic insomnia in my mid-30s. So I was in a relationship back then that was somewhat stressful, and that triggered what we call sleep onset insomnia, basically a fancy way of saying you can't fall asleep at night when your head hits the pillow.
Like you can't fall asleep and you can't stay asleep.
Well, I could stay asleep. Sleep maintenance insomnia is when you can't stay asleep. I had sleep onset insomnia. So once I was asleep, I was fine, but it was the getting to sleep. I would lie there for an hour or two every night, looking at the clock, sleep wasn't coming. And I got really frustrated after about 2 months of this. And I went to my doctor and I was given Ambien. And at the time I was a pharmaceutical sales rep. So medications, drugs were just like part of my daily life. It was like no biggie at all to take medication. So I just took it and it, you know, basically Ambien knocks you out. It's a false sedative. It's not a true sleep. So it got me to sleep more quickly, yet I had a lot of daytime consequences of fogginess, grogginess, feeling like I wasn't alert. And as it turns out, I was actually being overdosed. So in 2013, I know, not purposefully, but in 2013, the makers of Ambien were caught because they were essentially giving women twice the amount that they should, because they were doing their testing on men, as you know, a lot of drug companies have done over the years. And women were essentially getting overdosed. Women were, in fact, they were discovered to have more traffic accidents under the influence of Ambien the next morning. So it was incumbent upon the manufacturers of Ambien to lower the dosage. So I was being overdosed, unbeknownst to me, during that time period. And very, you know, at this point, I was in another profession. I was doing like PR and communications for a health department, and where I had to write really quickly, very press releases. And I got into trouble a few times because my brain wasn't functioning quickly enough to write in the morning. I was still drugged from.
And if anyone's been like struggled with brain fog, it's one of the worst things ever. You cannot focus. You cannot concentrate. It's horrific.
Yeah, it's bad. So I dealt with that whole situation for about 8 years. And then what really kind of got me off the Ambien was meeting a man who is my current husband, the one who, you know, we talked about earlier. And he said, you know, early in the relationship, when you take that sleep medication, wow, you become a zombie and it's freaking me out. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. Like I don't act right. You know, I'm like a complete zombie. So that got me on this trajectory of, okay, we're going to wean off. So I went rogue, as I often have done, and took myself off the medication.
Cold turkey, just didn't wean, you just stopped?
I did do the splitting, right? But I didn't do what I now talk to my clients about, and just anyone listening, if you are on a psychiatric medication, please talk to your prescribing provider on how to titrate safely, because it often takes a slower taper than the directions say. So go low and slow. Just be careful with that. I did end up getting off of the Ambien successfully and sleeping decently for many years. And then, da-da-da, March of 2020, the pandemic. We all had a collective experience with that. And I actually started sleeping poorly again because of that whole, like, what are we doing? Why can't we leave our house? You know, the initial stress of the unknown. So I got very worried about going back to that place of insomnia. So I started researching sleep and, you know, just looking up stuff, reading books. And I was posting on Facebook some of the things that I was doing to get my sleep back on track. And what I noticed was that a lot of women in my circle were like, this is so helpful because I'm having trouble sleeping too. And so this was, you know, a couple of years after the first breast cancer. So after the first breast cancer, I wanted to change careers and help women with their health. I wasn't sure how I would do that. I originally thought I'll be a breast cancer coach, but that seemed a little bit heavy. And so once I figured out how fascinated I was by sleep and how many other women were struggling, I was like, it was just a revelation I had. It was just like, I remember exactly where I was when I had this idea. And I told my husband, I want to be a sleep coach for women. And he was like, there you go. There, you've got it. You've got, like, and it was, I never looked back. It was just like, I was off to the races. Now, of course, you can't just hang up a shingle and go, I'm a sleep coach. You've got to put in the reps. You've got to understand and learn and train. And so I took a year of getting certified as a health coach from IIN, which is a pretty well-known health coaching curriculum, and then took various sleep coaching certificates because, unfortunately, a lot of health coaching programs don't really delve into insomnia. as they should. So I did a lot of education and then launched my sleep coaching practice in 2021. So it was just, everything leading up to that, it was just kind of a perfect scenario because I found what I really loved to talk about and to help people with. And it's just been such a joy and a privilege to be able to help women who are struggling with their sleep and not have to worry about taking medications to manage their insomnia and to help them to get off their medications. And before I go into any further, I just want to say that I'm very, very conservative with my approach. I don't pretend to be the doctor. I contract with my client who is on a medication and get the buy-in from the doctor, get them to sign off on the taper plan, and then we implement it. So I just want people to understand that I stay in my scope of practice.
Yeah, no, I think that's important to note too. But yeah, your pain, it's a pain of purpose story, right? Sometimes we have to go through these like biggest struggles and it puts us on our path to why we're here. And it kind of, it's true. You look back and you're like connecting the dots, like, oh, of course I got to this place. But when you're in it, trying to navigate it, it's hard because it's like, yeah, what do I do? Where do I go? And then bam, you know, when you found your purpose, like that's it. And you've probably, because you've been there and you understand the struggles of sleep and how much it can dysregulate you, you can relate to your clients in such a different way. You can communicate that to me in such a different way because you've gone through it yourself. And sometimes that's just not something that like a doctor can give us if they haven't gone through it. And it's, you know, it's helpful. So I think it's amazing what you're doing. And I'm sure you express to clients all the time too, how important sleep is. And do you believe that sleep is just as important as nutrition and exercise? Do you think it's one of those foundational tools that we needed at the end of the day?
So you think about the pillars of health being sleep, nutrition, and exercise. Yes, I'm biased, but I'm going to argue that sleep is the foundation upon which those other pillars stand.
Agreed.
Because if you think about it from this perspective, okay, if you're not sleeping well, if you're not getting enough quality sleep, are you going to make healthy food choices? Most likely not.
It's actually impossible. It's impossible.
It is. It is. Are you going to be motivated to go to the gym and take that class and add that extra 5-pound little thing on your dumbbell or whatever it is? You know what I mean? You're not going to have the motivation to push yourself to get more fit. So sleep is the bedrock of the whole pillars, I believe. And that's where I think that we need to start most often when people are dealing with, that weight loss resistance, they're having trouble losing weight. I know a lot of health coaches who are just like, if you're not sleeping, you're not going to be able to lose this weight. So like, let's get the sleep dialed in and then take it from there.
I agree 100%. I think sleep and nutrition go hand in hand, but I agree. It almost goes a little bit above because if you're not sleeping, your blood sugar is dysregulated. Your cortisol is then dysregulated and elevated, right? Your energy is down. Your metabolism cannot function. Not to mention, you're not getting melatonin, the anti-cancer hormone that cleans up your body, that helps with your mitochondria, like our cells, everything, right? It's just, it's like a ripple effect. And then you're not detoxing correctly too. So it's like, everything is built upon something that's so important, and that's sleep, right? Everything is built upon that, like you were mentioning. You can't work out. You can't make healthy choices when you're so dysregulated. And I always thought like, oh, it's impossible. But it's true. Like you're fighting against biological or physiological reactions that are happening in your body. I remember when I first had, I have two girls, and when they were like in newborn stages and stuff, you know, and you're never sleeping, I was not making the best choice. I mean, I was trying to make the best choices for food, but you're hungrier. You're always hungry. Your blood sugar is continuously on the roller coaster. So you're not able to always regulate as much as if you got that good night's sleep. And it just makes you feel like a completely different person.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, your hunger hormones just get really, really way out of whack. When you're sleep deprived, you're going to reach for the pizza before you're going to reach for the broccoli all the time, for sure.
Why do you feel like our society has normalized being exhausted all the time? I feel like every time I go on, so if I go on my social media account, especially because I'm a mom and I'm like, you know, see all the mom stuff, it's like wine and burnout is the, it's things that are being glorified, or I only got 3 hours of sleep, or, you know, whatever the case is, it's this constant glorification. And I just feel like our society has normalized not sleeping and being exhausted and almost celebrated it in a way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I feel like we are definitely a hustle culture. We glorify that. But I do, you know, having been deep in this work for now 5 years, I really have seen things start to turn around a bit. And people are starting to wake up to the fact that the hustle culture is backfiring on a lot of people, and people are running on fumes, getting sick. And I'm seeing the tide turn a little bit. Yet there is that undercurrent that you're seeing it. I'm seeing it too. But I do remain hopeful that things are going to continue to point into the direction of the anti-hustle culture and not glorifying always being busy and burnt out. It's no way to live. People will crash and burn. And I think a lot of people have gotten to that point and they get on the other side of it and they're like, I'll never go back there. Ever.
That's how I feel. I'm on the other side of it. And I was such a hustle. Like, I think that also contributed to my cancer diagnosis in such a big way, because it was go, go, go all the time. Resting was so uncomfortable for me. To take a step back felt so uncomfortable. Like, I physically couldn't do it. It would, like, give me anxiety. Like, I had to always kind of be doing something. And it's something I personally have had to actively work towards. And now it's like I've built my days around having breaks and making sure I'm not like overscheduling and burnout. But it's hard. It is hard. And it's hard when you have like a certain personality, like the type A personality, or you tie your identity or your self-worth to it, you know. So there's so much deeper work that needs to be done to really understand like that hustle culture too, so to speak.
Right. I think a lot of the work that we're doing now is helping women understand that their worth is not always, does not always have to be tied to their production level, you know, and how much they do during the day. And what I'm really also trying to work with my clients on is giving them permission to have things undone during the day. Like at night, like they may want to stay up and do their work, right? But it's really a matter of understanding that that work can wait until the next day. Find yourself a couple of priorities during the day, get them checked off your list, but then have a, like, some kind of a closing ritual where you shut your computer down at a certain time and you're like, okay, I've done X, Y, and Z that was on my list. The rest of the things, it can wait till tomorrow. There's always more to do tomorrow. And I think it is hard for a lot of our personalities. I'm very much the type A driven. I find myself having to give myself to lecture myself as well to protect that space.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier that you started to share like on social media steps on how you started to rebuild your sleep, or, you know, to after you've weaned off the medication to help yourself sleep more naturally better. What were some of those first steps that you took that put you on the right road to sleeping better?
Yeah. I think one of the things that I started doing first was getting light in the morning. And really, I think it started with the morning routine. So getting outside, getting light exposure very, very soon after waking up without sunglasses. Okay, a lot of people are like, why are you so hung up on sunglasses? What do you have against sunglasses? I think sunglasses are adorable. They are. They're cute. They're cute little accessories, but they're working against us in the morning because they're literally blocking those rays. So what the process is in the morning when you're looking at, I'm not saying look at the sun, but if your eyes are shielded, your brain is not going to get the signals. So what happens is the light hits your eyes, there's a signal that gets sent to your suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is your circadian pacemaker. And then there's this beautiful cascade of hormones and neurotransmitters that gets fired off, letting your body know the day has started. And the sunglasses block that process. So when I talk about don't wear sunglasses, I want to just say, you know, if you're driving into traffic and you can't see because of glare, put your sunglasses on by all means. But if you're taking a morning walk, you do not need to worry about like wearing sunglasses. Just take them off. Get just a little bit. You need a signal in the morning. It's not necessarily you need X amount of time, but your body needs to get that signal. So stepping outside and just getting that light in the morning is so very critical. And that's something that I was missing. So that was very, very, very impactful. And it's something that I have all my clients start with if they're not already doing it, because it makes a huge difference. And then I would say the second thing was keeping a regular schedule, keeping a regular wake up time, especially because that wake up time being regular is our circadian anchor. It is like one of the most essential parts of keeping our circadian rhythm moving along. So what I was doing, honestly, for many years was I was giving myself social jet lag. So what I would do was I would stay up really late on the weekend, sleep in a couple hours on the weekend. And then on Monday, I was wrecked. Like Sunday night, I couldn't sleep. And then Monday, I was wrecked. And by Wednesday, I had acclimated, only I just kept repeating that cycle every week.
I think a lot of people repeat that cycle too. I think that's probably one of the most common things that people are doing as we speak.
Totally. 100%. Most people are doing this. And, you know, I think we've kind of glorified or just glamorized, rather, this whole sleeping in is self-care. It's not really self-care. I mean, there are some nuances to this. I don't want people to think that, like, if they're out at a wedding and they get back at, you know, 12 midnight, they need to get up at 6. Like, give yourself ample time to sleep, but don't go too far. Like, maybe give yourself an extra hour tops to, you know, get that extra sleep, but keep it as regular as we can. It's just so critical.
That's really interesting too, because I feel like people think, oh, if I go to bed later, then I need 8 hours of sleep. I'm going to let myself sleep in and get like that full 8 hours. But I know what you're saying, because our body is so loves a rhythm and loves a routine and loves that set schedule. And so it can disrupt it, even though you might be sleeping in longer. So it's almost like getting up around the same time, going to bed around the same time is more important than getting essentially 8 hours if you're wrecking yourself every weekend.
Yeah. So we have this interesting, I call it the myth of 8 hours. It's been going on for a really long time. There's this glorification with getting 8 hours of sleep. And the reality is that not everyone needs 8 hours of sleep. So what we're really finding that is more important than the amount of hours is the consistency. And they even did a study on this a few years ago. They actually looked at like over 60,000 adults, and they tracked them. And they found that the people who had the most regular sleep schedules had 20 to 48% lower risk of death.
What?
Yeah, it's wild. So
that's a big statistic.
It's huge. And this research hasn't really been fully disseminated to the public yet. I think it's going to need to be brought into public health recommendations more than the 8 hours. But basically what they found is that regularity within like 30 minutes, so 30 minutes plus or minus deviation, it cut all-cause death risk by 49% and cardiometabolic risk by 57%.
That's huge. That is huge.
It's massive. Now, one thing I will say is that duration still did matter in these studies. So you want to get at least 6.5 hours, you know, most nights. But that doesn't offset erratic timing.
Yeah, that's huge. That's amazing. And you would think, like, if someone were like, oh, take this pill, it'll decrease your chances by 49% if blah, 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 like we would take it in a second. But just to hear that, the consistency over, and that makes sense too. You don't want to get under a certain amount of sleep, how many hours per night, but you want to hit like a sweet spot. You want to get enough in over 6.5 hours, but you want to be able to wake up consistently within 30 minutes of each going to bed and waking up in the morning to get that full benefit. Like that's amazing.
So people ask me this a lot, and they're like, well, what's more important, a consistent bedtime or a consistent wake time? It's always the consistent wake time. If you had to choose one, you're going to really want to anchor in that the most. Bedtime, I personally feel like you have a little bit more leeway. Maybe an hour, a little bit more leeway. But for the wake time, if you can get that wake time dialed in by 30 minutes, like this may be painful for some people to hear, Michelle, but like even on the weekend, like we were just talking about the social jet lag, if you can still make, like pick some, I would recommend people picking consistent wake time that they can live with every single day. Like, and be realistic with yourself, like really sit down and talk and have a talk with yourself about like, what time can I commit every day to this and make a plan to stick with it? It makes a world of difference.
And it's something so easy and it's free that you can do that's going to help. Like, it's something you just have to kind of commit to. And I'm on board. Like, I don't have the luxury to sleep in with young children anyhow, so I'm always waking up around the same time. But I know what you mean. Like, if I get a weekend where I can just sleep by Monday, or like sleep in by Monday, I am so screwed up, and you're so tired, and it's like, it's almost like a sleep hangover where you can't like shake it, you know?
Yeah, you get groggier and groggier. You don't actually feel refreshed. You just end up feeling groggier than you would have if you had just gotten yourself up. Because what happens is, if you get yourself up at that earlier time, like your normal time, you're going to have a lot of sleep pressure building up for that day, and you're going to get to sleep more easily, and you're going to get back on track more easily. So it's that slow drift that happens. That's why people, this is my theory, Michelle, my theory is people hate Mondays. People curse Mondays and think they're the worst day ever. I believe firmly it's because most people are jet lagged on Monday and they blame it on Mondays. It's not the Monday. It's your jet lag, honey. Social jet lag.
I agree. And I think it's really important when you said that it matters more about your wake time too, because I know also the second that light hits your eyes, it's telling cortisol to go away when your circadian rhythm starts sinking, but it's also telling melatonin, okay, it's safe for you to come out in 12 to 14 hours, right? So you're going to automatically get to bed more, quote unquote, on time, because you're syncing your hormones together. You're syncing that rhythm. Your body will naturally start to come down around that time when you're aligned with your circadian rhythm.
Absolutely.
So how dangerous is it when your circadian rhythm is completely off?
It can be, well, according to that study, you know, when people's circadian rhythm was that off from the inconsistent, that chronic disease, the cardiometabolic disease, and the all-cause mortality goes up. It can manifest, I think, you know, short-term as like weight gain. You know, when people's circadian rhythm is really out of whack, it's the weight gain, it's the mood disturbance, high blood pressure. I mean, people just, I think they just generally don't feel well. And I think a lot of the time they don't even, they're completely unaware that their circadian rhythm is misaligned. I think what's happened with our society, we've got this beautiful like ability to have whatever we want whenever we want it. You know, like I call it a beautiful ability. It's actually not that beautiful, but essentially you can get food whenever you want. You can have the night lit up brightly. Look at Times Square. it looks like the daytime. We can manipulate our light environment to be extremely bright at night. But if you think about our ancestors, you know, even 150 years ago, we didn't have that. We didn't have the luxury of having artificial light at night. So we were basically in a position where we were going to bed shortly after the sun went down. So what's happened is that in the past, we were getting bright days and dark nights, and now it's flipped over. So we're getting dim days and bright nights. We need to like flip that around again to match our ancestral heritage, really. We were built a certain way. Our biology was built a certain way, and a lot of us are living outside of our biology. And when you do that for a long time, you're going to, you know, pay the price. So if you go into a lot of homes these days, you're going to find people at 8, 9 o'clock with their huge like LED lights on overhead, and they're maybe scrolling on their phone late at night. And then they're wondering, why do I feel like crap in the morning? Why can't I get to sleep? So much of this can be eliminated by just light management in your house.
Yeah. There's actually been a lot of research out there too that circadian disruption can possibly increase cancer risk too. Like night shift workers, ER nurses, things like that. When your circadian rhythm is so disrupted, it affects your health and it can increase your risk for cancer. And that's because it's directly affecting our immunity, our immune surveillance, the ability to destroy, find, detect abnormal cells, you know, the ability to detox properly, you know, all of that. When you are working night shifts or you're up when you're supposed to be sleeping, everything kind of gets turned upside down.
Yeah, they really have been able to show a link between women who are doing overnight work, shift work, and breast cancer risk. And it is... it's really a conundrum, Michelle, because we need these valuable workers to handle emergencies at night, but they're paying the price. So, you know, ideally, what I would hope would happen is that people do these shift work careers for a matter of a few years, and then they should move people on. They should, because it's really, when you look at the studies, it's the women who are doing these night shifts for many, many years that are really getting hit with chronic disease. So, you know, people have to pay their dues in the beginning, pay your dues in the beginning with the shift work, and then have people cycle out of that after a few years and let the young people come through and let the older people go into the day shift is, I think, ultimately what should happen. But that's, you know, kind of unrealistic for the real world. But
no, I mean, but it's a great idea. It's a great idea for when you think about health in a holistic way, that would be a great way to rotate people in and out and just to protect your health and your peace in such a different way, you know? So you also mentioned inconsistent habits or everyday habits that people don't realize could be potentially hurting their sleep, such as you kind of mentioned we can get food and do like late night eating, you know, at different times, having blue light on through, you know, well into the evening, in inconsistent sleep times. Is there anything else that you're kind of seeing happen more commonly that is disturbing sleep that people might not even realize that they're doing?
I think what I'm seeing a lot of is people using alcohol as sort of like a way to relax into sleep. It's sort of like their treat in the evening. And what is happening is that, yes, they are falling asleep more quickly, but on the back end, their sleep gets disrupted. Their REM sleep cycle in the latter part of the night gets just disrupted. They will wake up more times in the night. They feel unrefreshed in the morning. And they even did a study showing that alcohol with each drink decreases your sleep quality exponentially. So one study showed that one drink for a woman decreased sleep quality by up to 24%. And when you add on each sequential drink, you're just taking even more of a hit on your sleep quality. So my guidance for people who want to still enjoy alcohol is to back it up. So instead of a nightcap, think about a happy hour. So have a drink at 5 o'clock, have one, two drinks max, cut it off. You know, don't start having your drinks after dinner at 8 or 9 o'clock, because if you really ideally want to allow at least 3 to 4 hours to clear off the alcohol before you go to bed. And I think a lot of people are just not doing that. I mean, on the rare occasion when I'm out, you know, past 8, which is hardly ever, you know, I'm seeing people just like open a bottle of wine. It's 8 or you watch, like, even watching TV. Just think about how often, if I don't know if you watch TV or not, but like, you see so many people on TV and the movies, you know, it's like late at night and they're like popping open a bottle of wine. I'm like, oh, you should have popped open that bottle of wine when it was still light outside, you know?
No, it's glorified for sure. Yeah. And it probably contributes to that weekend disrupted sleep. By the time Monday comes around, it just all, you know, all folds into one another.
Adding fuel to the fire. Absolutely. Social jet lag and alcohol use, like, you're done. You're toast. Other things that I see, not as much with my client population, but with a lot of people who are like in the hustle culture, it's the caffeine late in the day. Caffeine has a pretty long quarter life, and people really need to kind of be more mindful of like giving themselves a caffeine curfew somewhere around lunchtime is usually safe for most people. And then the bedroom environment can be really tricky for a lot of people. What's happening is a lot of people are having bedrooms that are too warm. For example, a lot of clients that I'm working with, you know, because I do a, you know, kind of an audit with their, not physically, because, you know, we're working on Zoom, but, you know, I'm asking really detailed questions about their bedroom. And what I'm finding is that so many women are hot at night. And one of the reasons is because of their bedding. They're sleeping with these big comforters. And those comforters are just trapping the heat. It's like this little microclimate inside where it's just, even if their AC is high, like in the 60s, that doesn't really matter because the temperature in the bed is so darn warm because of these comforters. So what I'm really trying to steer people away from is those thick comforters and getting more of like thinner quilts or like cotton, like not as much synthetic thick material and thick, thinner layers, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You know, as far as like light in the bedroom, that can be really, really a wake up for a lot of people. Having street lights come in from the bedroom into the bedroom, those little displays of electronics can actually be detrimental. You actually want to have it so dark in your bedroom that you really couldn't even see your hand if you put it in front of your face. That's how dark you want it. And one of the ways that, you know, we can get the darkness is get blackout shades or curtains. Those are becoming more popular. They're more price accessible. Some of them are still kind of pricey, but the eye mask is like the easiest fix.
Yeah, eye mask is like such an easy thing if you have something where you can't turn off in your room or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I recommend just people really focus in on getting the dark room, the cool room. You know, I'm a huge fan of these and I realize they're not cost effective for everybody, but the cooling mattress pads are a game changer, especially for women in midlife who are dealing with hormonal fluctuations and sleeping hot. They are just out of this world. Awesome. And then having, you know, a room that is quiet, you know, and it's hard to get quiet in a lot of rooms because there's street noises, there's random house creak noises you have sometimes, or pets or kids. So having some kind of way to mask that noise, whether that's a white noise machine or having earplugs that you could put in your ears, just having some way to keep those random noises from waking you, because a lot of us get so easily woken up by just tiny little noises, the micro wake-ups that we may not even be aware of.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great advice. It's such great advice. And keeping the room cool, all of that. I mean, it's just, again, it's easy tips and easy switches and swaps that we can make that just better support falling asleep and staying asleep and getting that good quality deep sleep. So I kind of already know the answer to this and I feel like we kind of touched on it, but can your morning routine actually determine how well you sleep that night?
Absolutely. Yeah. Good sleep starts the minute you wake up. the minute you get out of bed. Louise Hay has a very poignant quote.
I love Louise Hay. Yes. I listen to her every morning. I love her.
So how you start your day is how you live your day. And I'm a real big believer in taking the morning. Now, everyone has different life circumstances. So you have to kind of work with what you've got. But taking some time in the morning to carve out for intentionality and quiet. Whether that's, you know, 5 minutes of meditation or 5 minutes of breath work or just 5 minutes of silence. Setting your intentions for the day. Getting the light. Getting fed. I mean, I'm a reformed intermittent faster, Michelle. I'm gonna admit straight up. I was on a train for like 5 years where I didn't eat until 11 or noon. And I did not realize at the time how much of a disruption that was on my circadian rhythm and my nervous system regulation and my mood. I was not fun to be around then.
No, I hear you on that. Yeah.
I really, really suggest that people try to eat within an hour of sunrise and eat a very substantial high protein breakfast, because we really want to set our blood sugar up for regulation in the very beginning of the day, because our blood sugar regulation can often follow into the evening. And the blood sugar regulation is what can often trigger those middle of the night wake ups. So we want to make sure everything is lined up in the morning for our blood sugar with that high protein breakfast. Getting some movement also. It doesn't have, now I'm not a proponent of intense exercise like before sunrise. I know a lot of people balk at this because, and in reality, I will say it's sometimes the only time people can do their exercise.
It is. I know, which is like, okay, at that point, it's like, it's better to get it in than not. But if you can swap it and switch it. And I used to be like that. I used to do like 5 a.m. work, like, because I had young kids. It was the only time I could do it. And then I remember my body just started to get so inflamed and so puffy. And I'm like, I haven't changed anything. This is so weird. What's going on? And then I switched it where now I do a walk in the morning and then I do like my strength training in the afternoon or in the later morning, and I just figure it out. And it's, I feel like a million, I mean, it changed everything. It was like, I felt so much better.
It can make a world of difference. I feel like there are a lot of people who are very fitness conscious, which is awesome. But what they're doing is they're going to the gym really early and getting exposed to a lot of really bright blue light before the sun is even up. That can be very dysregulating for a lot of people. You know, if you have to work out, I mean, I know it sounds weird, but like maybe bring some like blue blockers to the gym, so, you know, to block out some of that, especially, you know, it, not only early in the morning, but also at night. Like if you have to work out at night, being mindful of what time you're working out in a gym. Because those lights are, they're no joke. Those lights in a gym, they're not circadian friendly. They're not looking out for your circadian health there.
They are not. They're there to keep you awake and to work out.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, mornings are critical for setting yourself up for a good night of sleep. I think that one of the biggest mistakes people make when they're trying to get on a better sleep journey or optimize their sleep is they're focusing too much on that hour before bed, and they're trying to put too much pressure on themselves to like be ready. You start getting ready the second you wake up, and so then the task is not as daunting, right? The hour before bed. It's an all day long process.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I really, really like that you said that. It is an all day process. It starts in the morning, but it's not just what happens at night. It's what you're doing consecutively during the day, how much caffeine you're taking in, when you're working out, how much calories and food you're getting in. Because we know if you eat too close to bedtime, you're spiking your blood sugar again. And when blood sugar is out, then melatonin cannot come out. And that's the, you know, we need that to help us feel sleepy. So understanding that your timing throughout the day really does impact your sleep. So I think that's such an important thing that you said there. Can I ask what your morning routine is?
Yes, you can. So it shouldn't be shocking, but I get up.
What time do you wake up?
It's funny. I was in the 5 a.m. club for a long time, and it was just my nature to be an early bird. Sometime around, I don't know, probably 5 months ago, I went on vacation, and it just sort of like happened that I would sleep a little bit later. And when I got home from my vacation, I maintained that schedule. And I've gradually, I think I'm waking up around 5:45 now, which is wild because 5 o'clock was the wake up time. Now, I was going through a little bit of a perimenopausal insomnia episode a few years ago where I was having a lot of 4:30 wake ups. That was really rough. But right now, things are good when I'm waking up around 5:45. I get up. I actually have my coffee immediately. People are like, what?
Before breakfast?
Before breakfast, baby. Yep.
You're crazy.
A lot of people think that. They're like, what the heck? But here's the thing. My body accepts it. Like, I actually did a cortisol test. It's a test where you can test your own saliva during the morning. Like, you don't have to send it away. You can get instant results.
Oh, cool.
Basically, I did a test on myself, and I would measure my cortisol like half an hour after I took my coffee, because the caffeine peaks about 30 minutes later. Cortisol was completely normal.
Oh, wow.
What I mean is that everyone has to kind of be their own N of one. There are a lot of people who swear by delaying their coffee. That is not me.
And that's okay. We're all bio-individual. It's okay.
But, you know, for a lot of people, that coffee first thing in the morning is going to make them kind of wacky. But I take to it really easily. So then I kind of just do some breath work and meditation. And then I get outside as soon as the sun comes up. I do wait for my husband will dawdle a little bit, but I gather my dogs, my husband, we go on a stroll. I come home and make my big omelet, and I have a fiber bar. So I'm getting like really good dense nutrition. And then I take another little walk, and then I do my actual workout. So I'm working out, you know, my cardio and strength training around 8 o'clock. And that's my morning. And I love it. But the downside is that I've missed opportunities for networking in the morning. I used, before COVID, when I was going to the gym really early, I would do like networking meetings in the morning at like 8 or 9. If someone is inviting me to be actually somewhere and dressed at 9 a.m., I'm like freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, I'm like still in my gym clothes. And I don't have children. So like, I'm kind of an anomaly. And I totally get the fact that there are a lot of women out there who couldn't even dream of this kind of morning routine, but you work with what you've got, right? So, but that is what I do, and I'm sticking to it.
I love it. So then on the flip side of that, like, what should our night routine look like? Our nighttime routine look like quickly? Mm-hmm.
So I think for the nighttime, what we really want to avoid is novelty, and you want to kind of keep, I know it sounds boring, but be boring at night, like kind of keep to a very predictable routine of a few wind down activities you can do. The main thing is keeping your lights dim. Like, I turn my lights off and I light a candle. I do watch TV at night, but I have the lights off, candle on, watching shows that are not stimulating. I'm not like the kind of person who's like screens are the devil. I don't really believe that. When you look at a phone at night, the lux on your phone is about 80 lux. It's not that bright. It's not bright enough to really make a huge dent in shifting your circadian rhythm. So the phones get demonized a whole lot for the light, but it's, you know what it is? It's actually the content on the phone. It's the stimulation. Especially if you're scrolling social media, it can be activating cognitively and emotionally. So you want to make sure that you're cognizant of the content you're consuming at night. Now, I'm not advocating for scrolling and on and on and on. You want to put a limit. Like, I put myself on a 30-minute limit on a scroll before I wind down. Like, you don't want to just keep going and going and going, because it's not necessarily the light. It's just you're cutting off your sleep opportunity by doing something else like scrolling. So I think that keeping the lights dim, keeping your cognitive activities on the low end. Like, you don't want to get into conversations with your partner or kids that are controversial. Like, you don't want to, like, you don't want to sit down and talk about a heavy issue with your spouse, like at eight or nine. You want to take care of that in the morning when people are fresh, because it can be too stimulating cognitively to get into some of those deeper discussions. So that would be my guidance. Keep it boring. Like, just keep your nights boring and predictable, and, you know, every now and then shake it up. But, like, for the most part, keep it kind of neutral.
Sure. So I feel like some of my clients, I've heard a lot of people say this too. Some people can fall asleep, they can stay asleep, but bam, they're waking up at 3 a.m. or somewhere between 2 and 4 a.m. and they're like, I'm wired, or I can't fall back asleep. Like, what's up with that? What's going on? Why is somebody waking up at that time, and what's kind of happening in the body, and what can they do in that moment to help calm themselves down to go back to bed too?
Literally the most common complaint that my clients have. So there's a lot to say about this. In fact, I wrote a free guide about it that's on my website. It's totally free. So that goes deep into this. But to answer your question, there are a lot of different reasons why people are waking up in the middle of the night, 2, 3 a.m. A few of the most common ones that I'm seeing from my client perspective are being too hot. And it doesn't necessarily mean hot flashes or night sweats, just being overheated. Maybe the comforter's on. Maybe the temperature's too high in the house. Also, blood sugar dips. So it's that lack of blood sugar regulation during the day. Sometimes we might need to have somebody have a really small snack, like an hour before bed. Now, I'm not talking about ice cream and cookies. I'm talking about, like, a little bit of Greek yogurt with a few almonds as a way to stabilize the blood sugar. And then a biggie, we can't have a sleep episode without me mentioning this. It would be criminal. One of the biggest culprits that I'm seeing, now I deal a lot with women in midlife, 40 plus, is sleep apnea issues, sleep breathing disorders, waking people up in the middle of the night. And I'm talking about women who, you look at them, you would think they don't have sleep apnea. They're not overweight. They don't have a big neck. But what happens with women in menopause is that they're losing those hormones, and those hormones can be protective of the airways. So I really think that anyone who is routinely waking up in the middle of the night really owes it to themselves to have their sleep breathing measured, tested. And the good news is you can get them for like less than $200 sent to your home, done in the privacy of your own home. You have a telehealth visit with a doctor. If you do have sleep apnea, you do not always have to have the CPAP machine or that mask. You can often get an oral appliance. In fact, a lot of my clients, women 40 plus with mild sleep apnea, are getting treated with an oral appliance. So it's just like something in your mouth, and it helps open their airway enough. Those are just a few that scratch the surface of nighttime awakenings. How to deal with them is, remember that in the middle of the night, your brain is not operating from a place of rationality. You're really operating from your amygdala. You're operating from that kind of more emotional center of your brain, not your rational side of your brain. So it's very normal to have catastrophic thoughts in the middle of the night. Have you ever had that happen? When it's happened to me before, where I wake up at 3, the things that I think of at 3 o'clock, at 8 a.m., I'm like, why was I even thinking such crazy things?
Yeah. I think a lot of my clients too, like, a lot of big anxieties come up at that time. And then rumination happens around that time too. And it's like, you can't get off the merry-go-round because you're ruminating about certain things, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we can remind ourselves of in the moment is that, like, maybe have a mantra: I'm not thinking out of my rational brain right now. Things are going to be better in the morning. I'm not going to have this perspective in the morning. It's just, it's often the awareness that that's going on that can de-escalate that kind of, like, feeling of, like, overwhelm and anxiety. So there are different things you can do. There's the, from the cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia perspective, it's get out of bed and go to another room and do something in dim light that's not stimulating until you become sleepy again. That's one way of dealing with it.
Oh my gosh. I don't think that would keep me awake for the rest of the night if I did that. Like, that would not work for me.
Yeah. And that's why there's not a one size fits all. That can be something that works for a lot of people, but a lot of people actually just want to remain in bed because getting up can be too stimulating. So what you can do in bed is you can do some body scans. You can do some breath work in bed. You can do, an exercise called cognitive shuffling, where you basically take a word like apple and you think of every single word you can, starting with the letter A. Once you can't think of any more, you go to the P. And you just kind of bore yourself to sleep. You bore yourself to sleep. So things that you can do in bed to kind of distract yourself. What I would really suggest that you not try is not look at the clock.
And going on your phone and Googling, like, did Jesus have hair or something? And like going down the rabbit hole.
You do not get on your phone and start messing around on your phone. Knowing the time never helps. It never helps, because then we start doing sleep math, right? And going, oh my God, I've only got 3 hours of sleep until I have to wake up in the morning.
And then the anxiety kicks in and you're like, oh my God, then I'm only going to get 2 hours and then 1 hour. Yeah.
Just escalates. I would say, and now this is for a lot of the clients that I've worked with who they're like, I'm up at 4. I might as well get up and start my day. So they'll start working. And so the lights come on, the computer comes on. And what happens is you're kind of like training your brain to expect to work at that time. So you're really, people are sometimes, unbeknownst to them, are perpetuating the wake ups by watching or by looking at the clock, by getting up and working. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to like start our day, our work day, our normal day, and start our coffee rituals at that time in the morning if we happen to wake up too early. So,
okay. So what are your thoughts on like sleep gummies or the melatonin gummies and different sleep aids and crutches like that? I mean, I know how you feel about Ambien for sure, but like, do you still think that those have a time and place?
I think there's a time and a place for supplements, but what I would say is that you want to think about the basics that we've already covered. You want to think about getting your routine dialed in with the light, with the consistent bed and wake time, with your food. You want to make sure all of those things are taken care of. And then the supplements are sort of like the addition that come after those foundational habits have been established. In my population of clients who for the most part have insomnia, with where they have conditioned arousal, they have sort of this fear of being awake, supplements are not terribly helpful. They're not strong enough to overcome that powerful kind of cognitive arousal. But if you're looking to just kind of amp up your sleep quality a little bit, I think supplements can have their place. There's not like a whole ton of like really solid research on them. And quite often what's happening is there's a placebo effect, and there's not anything wrong with a placebo effect. But sometimes these things get expensive. These supplements get expensive. I have a client right now who's taking like 5 different sleep supplements, and she's working with me to wean off of each one. Or she might leave a couple, like she might leave melatonin and magnesium, but you know, that's like hundreds a month, right? That are probably not doing really much at all for her at this point in time.
Yeah. I love what you said though. I love that you said, I agree with you too. I do feel like people are over relying on supplements without fixing the foundations first, because 9 times out of 10, if you're fixing the foundations, you're not going to need that support. And we can't just throw supplements at everything if the foundation is broken. You cannot build a house on a broken foundation. So I'm so glad that you said that, because there's so much out there and there's so many supplements being thrown and marketed to us all the time. It's harder to stop and be like, let me sync my circadian rhythm. Let me cut back in the caffeine. Let me balance my blood sugar throughout the day. That's harder than being like, I'm going to pop some ashwagandha at the end of the night or whatever the case is, you know?
Well, it's just the way our society is. It's like we want the easy button for it, right? And supplements are advertised as the easy button, but they don't necessarily really move the lever that much. I mean, some people swear by them. If they work for you, great. I would say if you're going to delve into a supplement, you really want to make sure that the supplement is of good quality, third-party tested, maybe pharmaceutical grade. I'm not a huge fan of the gummies. They do tend to have some sugar. Sometimes those kinds of products are not very regulated and they don't have what they say they have in them. So it's just a buyer beware situation. And just, you know, I would not go and, you know, get your melatonin at the drugstore. I would, you know, order it from a better source. But I'm not opposed to melatonin because it's a really powerful antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. And we do know that as we get into our 50s, our melatonin secretion decreases. So it's often really helpful to have a little microdose of that melatonin to supplement what we have lost from aging.
Yeah, or can't naturally produce anymore, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'd be crazy not to ask you this. I know we're kind of wrapping up here, but do you personally use like any of those Oura Rings or sleep trackers or Apple Watches? Like, I feel like so many people are obsessed with, I don't use any of them. And it's not because I think a certain way. I just know for me, it would be anxiety producing. I would focus too much on it because I can default as a perfectionist. It would be more, cause more harm than do more good for me personally. But do you feel like these devices are good? Is it accurate, good information at our fingertips, or is it producing anxiety?
Well, first of all, I have to commend you for having that self-awareness that you wouldn't be a good candidate, because it sounds like you wouldn't. A lot of people are not that self-aware, Michelle. They're like, well, everyone's got a sleep tracker. It's what I'm supposed to have. And they get it. And then they end up going kind of nuts because they're like over-fixating. There's a term called orthosomnia, which is basically an over-fixation on your sleep numbers and your sleep data. And that can create even more sleep problems than you started with.
Right, which is crazy.
So you don't want that.
No.
I think that they can be helpful tools for some people when a person is able to look at their data and then make behavioral decisions based on the data that they see. So for example, I'll use myself. I have an Oura Ring and I also have a Whoop. So I'm using two. I don't recommend using more than one, but I'm a professional. I can handle it. And this is my job. So I'm going to stick with my two.
Preach. Amen.
So for me, for example, I noticed that if I had alcohol too late, like it would really, really mess with my sleep. Or if I had a dinner too late, terrible sleep scores, terrible recovery scores. So what I really try to be intentional on doing is finishing my food by 6 p.m. every night. Now, there are exceptions. There are dinners out. You know, you have to have a life. But for people who can look at their trends and be like, oh, okay, I see when I do this, this happens. It's not good. So let me see if I can change my behavior and then change the results of the sleep tracker. So that can be good.
So what makes it not good? Like, are you supposed to be in a certain range or a certain compartment of sleep, like your deepest sleep for a certain amount of time? Like, how are you actually ranking it?
So each different device has their own little algorithm. But I will, because you mentioned it, I feel like I should complete this thought, is that they do break it down into staging. So each tracker will say you got 25% REM sleep and, you know, 13% deep sleep. Okay. Now, this is the part of the sleep tracker that is the least accurate. And it's unfortunately the part of the sleep tracker that people get the most hung up on. They get really hung up on, oh my God, I didn't get enough deep sleep. Like, I have so many older clients. So I have to say that as you get older, your deep sleep does naturally decrease. So I had a client who was 60 and was comparing her deep sleep score on her Oura Ring with her 30-year-old daughter. I'm like, never do that again, because you're at an unfair advantage with your age. You can't, it's completely like apples and oranges. So people just need to understand that the sleep stages are the least accurate part of the sleep tracker. but you can measure like so many things. I think a valuable measure is one is sleep duration, sleep consistency. I know Whoop is really, really big with that. They've really like hone in on that, which I think is smart because they've kept up with the data, like we talked about earlier, and the health benefits of maintaining that consistency. They're going to talk about sleep efficiency, which is a really important number. So a sleep efficiency score is basically looking at how much of all the time that you were in bed last night, how much of that time were you actually sleeping? So we want to aim for a higher consistency for sleep. So you want to look at 85% sleep consistency or above for being like a healthy sleeper. Now, if you have a one-off, a bad night or whatever, and you have lower than that, not to worry. But overall, you want to like aim for being asleep 85% of the time you're in bed at night. But I mean, there's recovery scores. I look at that quite a bit because I'm focusing on that stress resilience piece. So my HRV, heart rate variability, my heart rate, my respiratory rate, I'm looking at all those things.
So it's not just important to focus on like REM cycle and deep sleep cycle. Like it's so much more than that.
It's so much more than that. And I would say of all the things to like focus on least, it would be the staging. Because the reality is that we don't have very much control of the staging. So we can control the inputs that we have during the day. Like we can control our schedule to some degree, our food intake, all those things we've talked about, those variables. But once we've actually gone to bed and our brain is in the sleep mode, we don't have control. We have like, Jesus, take the wheel, you know?
So if someone's like, oh, I have a really short deep sleep cycle, there's really nothing you can do to trigger that stage to happen more or longer.
There's not really a whole lot you can do, which is just disconcerting to a lot of people because we want to control everything. You can do one of the thing that you can do to increase your deep sleep that has been backed up by a lot of studies is exercise. Moderate exercise on a regular basis has been shown to increase deep sleep. Sleeping cool, having your dinners earlier, that personally for me sets me up for a deeper sleep, but not every single night is going to be deep, even despite those practices that I do every day. So what I would also suggest for people who are sort of like borderline, like might get too wrapped up in the data, is wear the device every day, but then don't take the dashboard out until like Sunday. So look at your stats every Sunday to see like, if there's anything that you should be alerted on or think about changing. But then if by doing that, you're not getting swept up in the everyday headlines of your sleep tracker. To me, it's a nice balance.
I think that's really good advice. Yeah. And then you can see like any patterns throughout the week that's happening or from day. Yeah. So you're not just focusing on it day to day. You're looking at it at a 7-day glance.
Right. Exactly.
I love that. Okay, well, that's really helpful too. All right, I have a couple rapid fire questions before I let you go, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, most underrated sleep habit?
It's got to be the consistent wake up time. But just having worked with so many people, they're always like, that helps so much.
No, I trust you. Biggest mistake people make with sleep?
Sleeping with the temperature too warm, I would say, would be a big one. There are many, but that's just coming up at the top of my head right now.
That's the big one. Okay. One thing you never do before bed.
Eat.
Best thing for someone waking up at 3 a.m.
Breath work.
Okay. And one sleep product you actually love.
Oh, don't kill me, but it's the 8 Sleep mattress pad.
Okay.
It's expensive, I know. But if I had to give this a second one, it would be a sleep mask.
Listen, you should be bougie about something. It should be your sleep, the most important thing, right? That's okay. Like that's a great suggestion. I love this. Thank you so much for all of your expertise. I really appreciate it. Can you tell the audience, tell us about like your sleep program, your coaching program, and then where they can find you and where they can gather more information about your programs too? Because honestly, you are so intelligent in this area. You can tell that you're passionate about it. You know exactly what you're talking about. I just think so many people listening who, if they are struggling with sleep, could really benefit from working with a coach like you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that invitation. So I work with people one-to-one. So it's a very like intimate kind of setting. We work over Zoom. I can see people anywhere in the world, which is awesome. We have that technology to do. Most of the people that I work with are dealing with insomnia. So that's really kind of my wheelhouse. I have a couple of resources on my website. It's morganadamswellness.com. You can either get that free guide on 3 a.m. wake-ups, download the free guide. You can also sign up for a consultation. So if you feel like you might want to work with somebody to get that individual one-to-one help, you can do that on my website. And I'm also very active on Instagram. The handle is morganadams.wellness. You can find me there. Get into my DMs and say hello. I love to talk about sleep, and I don't want anyone to be a stranger. I'm very approachable.
Yes, fantastic. And you guys, I will link in the show notes her freebie and her the consultation link too, so people can easily access you. So I'll get all the information. It'll be linked in the show notes. So if you guys are loving this episode, if you want to know more about sleep, DM Morgan, reach out to her. Again, you guys, sleep is one of the most important parts of our foundation for overall health and longevity and for cancer prevention and recovery, all of it, all of the things. But thank you so much, Morgan. You've been such a pleasure to speak with. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Michelle.